you all. It's quite an honor to be here, and thank you to Yonsei University for having me. So I've chosen to speak about education and learning today. Why am I talking about education? Why am I talking about learning at a technology conference? Well, actually, education and technology go really well together today because technology expands the reach of innovations in education as never before. Because the internet is so pervasive and because technology is so pervasive, millions of people have access, hundreds of millions of people have access to technology to enable them to learn as never before. Furthermore, lifelong learning is increasingly important. How many of you are programming in a programming language today that you learned years ago? I know that I'm not using the programming languages that I was trained in when I was a student. We all are going to have to continue to learn as we continue through our careers, throughout our lifetimes, because technology is changing so quickly. And online learning lends itself well for lifelong learning. Furthermore, student work lends itself very well to data about thinking, because when students learn, they need to express how they're thinking. And this can help us learn not only about learning, but about psychology and artificial intelligence and other topics like that. And finally, professors such as myself are very well positioned to study education. So professors often do research, and professors work with students, and so we might as well study education. Oh, I should be using this one. Okay. Furthermore, online learning is increasingly popular. The rise of massive open online courses, or MOOCs, although it doesn't get the press that it used to get, it's still incredibly popular. And so there's now 35 million students enrolled in online courses on MOOCs that are often free or that for a small fee they can earn a certificate. And more than 500 universities are offering MOOCs. Khan Academy, which is an incredibly popular site for taking small courses, learning about topics and doing exercises online, has more than 5 billion problems solved as of today, and more than 37 million registered students. And instructors are using Khan Academy in their classrooms. They're having students take Khan Academy courses to learn while in the classroom. And online courses are not just about science and technology. They span the subject matters from business to humanities to education and teaching and art and design. And MOOCs, or massive open online courses, continue to be offered. In 2016 was the biggest year ever in terms of the diversity of the kinds of courses that are being offered, and both session-based, meaning where all the students learn together, and self-paced. And the diversity is really quite staggering. This is just one screenshot of the courses being offered by FutureLearn, which is out of the United Kingdom. And not only are the standard sorts of subject matters like finance being offered, but you can learn about food as medicine, fairy tales, how to survive on Mars, how to identify fraudulent food, and ecosystems. So the diversity of topics is staggering. Basically, if you want to learn about something now, you can take a free online course to learn about it. And the language diversity as well is enormous. In fact, Class Central reported that there's now a major platform in China for MOOCs, which just crossed 5 million learners. So it's multilingual and multicultural as well. It's a phenomenon that started in the Western world, has spread to Asia, and is increasingly popular. And this was developed by Tsinghua University. Learning at scale unleashes creativity, not just in the students, but in the professors that create courses as well. Instructors are motivated to innovate, not only because teaching at scale is so challenging, but because other people see how they innovate. Other professors see the innovation, and the students as well. And people are motivated to create new kinds of interactive exercises and new styles of presentation. Here's an example I like by my colleague Barry Nailbuff. He's a professor at Yale who teaches negotiation, and he has a new way of teaching it and a new MOOC for teaching it, where he uses these animations about a pie, and he is very engaging animations online, but he also requires the students to meet up with other students and actually practice negotiating as part of this online course. Another important aspect of online courses is that they've moved away from the standard lecture format, where someone just stands and talks like I'm doing now, and the students just passively listen. Instead, there's an emphasis on active learning. Active learning means the students get involved. They only listen for, say, 10 minutes at a time, and then they do an exercise. This is a screenshot from Peter Norvig's original AI MOOC, in which it was very crude, it was handwritten, but there was an exercise when he was explaining how to do a natural language processing parse, and then the students had to figure out what this parser was going to produce, what was the right parse at the end. And now active learning has been studied in the educational community for years, but it's really been catching on because of MOOCs. And it's been shown in dozens, if not hundreds of studies, that active learning improves not only learning outcomes, but all aspects of learning in terms of attendance, in-person courses, in terms of engagement, and other aspects. So this was a controlled study where the control is in blue, and the experimental condition where active learning was introduced is in orange. And this shows that all factors were improved in the active learning case. So active learning means doing activities, not just passively listening. And MOOCs are really causing people to innovate in how they introduce active learning into their courses. So I believe that learning at scale can lead to new understanding about learning, about psychology, about AI, and we can do large A/B or experimental tests at scale with active learning. And it's going to improve research. So pedagogy, which is the science of teaching, will feed into research and vice versa in a virtuous cycle and will influence our understanding of topics we don't understand well now, like how to debug a program. We're learning more about how to debug by trying to teach people how to debug at scale, for example, or how to do exploratory data analysis, which is a topic I teach. If we see how people do that at scale, we'll understand this very complex topic at scale. We'll understand this topic in general better by studying how people do it at scale. So that's the introduction to my talk, and now I'm going to talk about, in detail, four general areas. I'm going to talk about natural language processing for writing instruction. I'm going to talk about games for learning, artificial intelligence for automating feedback, and advances in peer learning. And these are all tied together by the idea of if we're trying to help people learn online or learn at scale, advances that we'll have in these fields corresponding to these. So first, can natural language processing help with writing instruction or help students learn to write better? Well, this is a screenshot from a tool called Grammarly that tries to help students with their writing. So Microsoft Word for decades has corrected our grammar as we write, but rather than correcting a student when they're learning, you want to coach the student. You don't want to tell them the right answer, you want to give hints. And so what this tool does is it actually does give the hint. It underlines it at first and says, you know, there's something wrong here. And if you click on it, it'll show you the correction. And so that can be helpful for learning. But here I deliberately typed in what I consider to be ESL errors. ESL is English as a second language, or people that are learning a language that's not their native language. And they'll make errors like hike of a mountain, which should have been up a mountain, or went upstream to gorge, which is, it should be to the gorge, but it could mean to gorge on food. And the beautiful day, it should have been, this is a beautiful day, and so on. And these are errors that are not caught by Grammarly currently. They're difficult errors to catch. And so the state of the art of natural language processing isn't yet there to catch these style of ESL errors. Here's another system. It's actually used in the school systems in the US today. It's called Write to Learn. And it uses latent semantic analysis, which is a statistical technique where it examines lots of essays that have been written by schools and finds commonalities. And then it makes suggestions about what sort of feedback to this, how the students can improve their essay. So here it says the student got 3 out of 6 in the idea scale, and 3 out of 6 in the organization scale, and so on. And it suggests the students revise their essays to improve their scores. And sure enough, students do improve their scores with this tool, but It's really more because they are encouraged to revise their essay. These scores could be really more accurate. And in fact, the researchers who've worked on this tool say it doesn't really accurately measure sentence fluency and conventions. So there needs to be a lot of improvement in how to measure these aspects of essay writing. But we do know that it does encourage students to revise their essays and improve their writing. So this style of approach of coaching students in their writing has been shown to be effective. And if we can improve this, we can further improve people's writing. And here's some work out of China, actually, on trying to help ESL writers with mining text to find common phrases. And then after the user writes one word, it suggests other phrases that might complete that phrase. So it's another angle in natural language processing of trying to help a second language learner with their writing. So parsers are about grammar checking. If you are familiar with natural language processing and parsers, so they're for about compliance with a grammar or correcting. But what we really want is something to give hints about what to do next or to coach in writing. So how might we make a parser that reads alongside as the student writes and tries to coach as they consider choices and considers the common errors that the student is about to make and learns the best examples to show? And what does a grammar look like for this? So an alternative to writing a traditional grammar in natural language processing might be to consider the following scenario. Imagine thousands of students all writing the same essay, the same prompt response for an essay, and responding to coaching from both a program and a teacher. So what we could do is have students assigned to write an essay and doing some kind of an A-B test on the fly and see which suggestions from a program help the students the most. So say we take the first 100 students and tell them to start writing, and we have our program give them feedback. And depending on which feedback the students accept, we then modify the program and have it learn, kind of how Peter Lee was talking about in the first lecture. And then another 100 students start to write their response to the essay, and they get feedback, and the program learns from that, and so on, until we really figure out how best to make an essay coach. I think this would be a really plausible way to improve a program that coaches students or improve a tutor, because we have so many students that need to learn how to write. They should be willing participants in this kind of exercise. So I've talked about how natural language processing might help with writing, but what about with studying? So you all are students, and you've probably experienced that sometimes when the teacher assigns you something to read, you don't really understand it so well. Maybe you didn't have the right prerequisites, you didn't have the right background, or it's just hard to understand. So a project that I'm working on with some students is to help with this situation. So you don't understand this passage, so what if you could be assigned some alternative passages from another book, other books, or maybe some videos to watch that are just about what you were assigned to read, but maybe that take your background into account. So you're happy. So we did a little work on this where we started with a video in Khan Academy, and we crawled the text of some textbooks from OpenStax, which are open source textbooks, and we linked them up together to try to find an alternative explanation for the video from the textbook. So we have a happy student. And this wasn't too difficult to do when the two are aligned well. And we're pursuing this as a major research project. And I think others will continue to do this. When I was a student, there was very little available to read about. You had to read the textbook, and that was your only choice. Now I find that students are overwhelmed by the choices, and they don't know where to look. They don't know which to choose, and so they just go to Wikipedia. So what we think technology can help with is helping the students with the suggestions of the most relevant alternative passages to read, given their background. So in summary, natural language processing to aid in studying and writing gives us new ways to think about writing parsers and opportunities for other parts of natural language processing, like paraphrasing and discourse structure, if you're familiar with this particular field. And an exciting opportunity for a new kind of data collection as well. For example, we can hold the meaning or the semantics constant and vary the expression by assigning all the students the same essay topic to write and observing the writing while it happens, varying in real time your algorithm to respond to coach the students and see what works well. And natural language processing to recommend related readings to keep students from getting stuck. All right, so I've talked about NLP for writing instruction. Now I want to talk a little bit about artificial intelligence for automating feedback. So what do I mean by feedback? Well, let me digress for a moment to talk about mastery learning. Mastery learning is an idea from pedagogy. Pedagogy, again, is the science of learning or of education. So Salman Khan talks about the Swiss cheese model of learning. Swiss cheese is cheese with holes in it. And the idea is, if you don't learn something thoroughly before going on to the next step, you have a weak foundation. It's like learning to ride a bike without first getting balance down. So it's really important that students learn the fundamentals, the foundations, before they move on to the next step. But at least in the United States, we move students along because that's the timing. You know, they're done with first grade, they go to second grade to third grade, whether or not they've mastered the subject matter. And so with mastery learning, the idea is you learn the subject matter and then you move on. But mastery learning requires feedback. It requires lots and lots of examples, sometimes for students to practice. And so what people are working on now that's exciting in technology is automated ways to give lots of examples with answers or personalized examples with answers. So there's this really wonderful algebra game called Dragon Box, and what some researchers in Popovic's group have done is personalized this game. I'm just going to show a little beginning of the video to show how this game works. What's really wonderful about it is it starts with little pictures, and the pictures turn into algebra symbols over time. But kids learn with the pictures first, and they learn to manipulate these images. And then these turn into, you know, dice, and then they turn into algebra symbols. And so the abstract nature of the symbols is not intimidating because they just sort of naturally come out of the game. And the game is, you know, really fun to play. And so what Popovic et al. Did is they learned how to personalize which they learned if students were quickly mastering this game or needed extra examples from this game to learn algebra. And they were then able to run this, they had whole cities play this game, or whole states play this game. And they were able to see how long it took before kids mastered this algebra playing this game. And here they have some statistics over how long it took. So eighth graders were able to master algebra in 1.5 hours, and younger kids took longer. And of course, the kids love to play this game, so they play it longer than they have to in order to master the concepts. So it was a personalization plus the mastery learning of having many, many examples of the problems instead of just a few problems in a worksheet that make the difference here for mastering the concept. They also then tackled word problems. I don't know if you have these word problems in Korea, but in math in the United States, they have these problems like, Susie is 10 years older than Billy, and next year she will be twice as old as Billy. How old is Susie now? So these are not very inspiring kinds of questions. And so they thought, what if we made this more interesting, and we made this more like a story, and we let kids choose the characters and the themes, like fantasy or science fiction or wizardry like Harry Potter. And then they use templates and constraint solvers to make logical relations between the characters. Sometimes they also let the kids name the characters, and they can name them after themselves or their friends. And this makes this a lot more exciting. And then they use discourse tropes and coreference resolution, which are ideas for natural language processing. And so then they ended up with really exciting things like this. Knight Alice has 30 chalices. These are knight sort of words. Dragon Elliot has 9 chalices. Alice slays the dragon and takes his chalices. How many chalices does she have now?
And the idea would be that the kid's name would be Alice and her friend's name would be Elliot. And so it would be much more exciting and they'd get buried treasure and so on. And they had programs to generate these in a game-like setting so kids would do the word problems for hours and hours and they would really master them. Another example of mastery learning via automated feedback comes in engineering. So my colleague at Berkeley, Sarah McMaines, and her students had this problem in engineering where there's a way for 3D modeling, it has to be represented in engineering by these 2D schematics. The problem is it's very particular how these have to look, and it's very difficult for the teaching assistants to grade these. So this is a correct rendition, and this is incorrect, but it's very hard to see why this is incorrect. If you're the teaching assistant trying to grade this, it turns out it's missing the line right there that's there. But you know, you're gonna go blind trying to see this if you're a grader. And here's, this one is also incorrect because this is a little bit too high. So they wanted to make a program to do this checking. And so here in this case, this is the instructor's solution and this is the student's solution. What's wrong here? Well, it turns out this is sort of the wrong shape and it's a little bit too big and so on. And a straightforward automated solution would find all sorts of things wrong here and it's just is crazy, but they actually came up with a really sophisticated solution that really marked exactly what was wrong by rescaling everything and just saying, okay, these parts are missing and that's wrong and right there and those dotted lines are missing. And so the idea is because they were trying to give feedback to students, they came up with this really wonderful, sophisticated engineering solution that they wouldn't have done if they were not trying to teach and educate. This is a similar example by some work by Rich Baraniuk's group at Rice University, where they wanted to give feedback on calculus. And so this is a correct solution. But more importantly, they wanted to give partial credit. They didn't want to just say it's wrong. They wanted to sort of show approximately where in the derivation the students got it wrong. And so here's the correct solution and here's an incorrect solution that would get 1/3 of the points. And they were able to use kind of a text analysis technique plus a kind of Python program that does some resolution to show at each step the probability that the derivation is correct and the expected grade. And so here the first step was right, but the second step starts to go wrong and so on. So really exciting innovations that people are doing in automated feedback in order to support learning at scale. It's a really exciting area if you're in artificial intelligence or related areas in engineering. And we'll talk about some other things for the design area coming up. All right, so I just talked about AI for automating feedback. Now I'm going to talk about games for learning of different things. So one question people have been asking is, can we convert a homework problem into a game? Will that improve learning? Now there's plenty of ways to make a game that does not improve learning. So I'm not saying that if you make everything into a game, it will help learning. That's not true. But there are ways to do it. There have been some successes. So this paper was just published at Learning at Scale that actually was just sort of a straightforward statistics problems. And what they did was they made it possible for the students to play against each other, see how many points they were getting right, and kind of have badges and so on. And sure enough, the students retained the insights that they learned longer, and they were more accurate when they were doing it, some of the students at least, when they were doing it in a gamified setting. Here's an example for language learning. So this was a game for non-Chinese speakers to learn Chinese tones. And the idea was they would see a written version of a word, and they would have to guess, or not guess, but they would have to tap which of the tones representations was correct. So for example, for these, I'm not going to attempt to say it, but for this versus this, if they tapped the right tone representation, there would be a green background, otherwise a red background. But what we've also often seen is that and Peter Lee also talked about this, in a social setting, games can really help reinforce learning. So there was a project called Tone Wars, which is a game to learn Chinese tones with other people, where non-native speakers got paired up with native speakers in real time. And this was effective. So I'm going to show a kind of a fun video of this.
Tone Wars is a collaborative educational game that joins second language learners and native speakers to learn Chinese tones. Tones are pitch inflections that accompany spoken syllables. When pronouncing characters, they are crucial to convey proper meaning. For example, ma could mean horse or mother, depending on the tone spoken. With Tone Wars, students build knowledge of which tones correspond to certain characters. Phrases drop into their screen and stack to the top. By slashing phrases with the tones of each character, players clear their stack and earn points. Tone Wars provides three features for effective learning. First, players control the game through touch and voice. In classrooms, some students trace tones as they pronounce characters. Similarly, in Tone Wars, players draw shapes of tones of characters. They can also read them out loud to practice tone pronunciation. Second, the game joins learners with native speakers. The two players compete for a higher score. Learners gain confidence through victory, and the game strengthens learner attacks when they are behind to give them a fair chance to keep fighting. Third, Tone Wars records native speaker sessions to be used for offline competition. In the future, learners will be able to play against these pre-recorded experts at any time, regardless of native speaker availability. Let's see Tone Wars in action. Claire is a first-year, second-language learner of Mandarin. On a study break, she finds Tone Wars, a game for practicing tones for phrases she learned in class. After connecting to a native speaker, she slashes Chinese phrases with the shapes of tones of the characters. As she does this, she keeps her screen from overflowing. With each match, Claire saves up ammo. By tapping a button, she drops blocks to clutter the stack of her opponent. Her score tells her when she is matching tones more successfully than the native speaker, which motivates her to continue playing. In the future, Claire will be able to compete even if disconnected from a network. Playing against a pre-recorded native speaker, she will experience engagement and personal satisfaction in her success, just like before. In conclusion, Tone Wars is an educational game that joins second language learners with native speakers to practice Chinese tones. Tone Wars helps players buff up on their knowledge of tones.
Okay, so part of what was great about that is the interaction between the two cultures, and the English speaker is handicapped, so because of course the native speaker is going to be better at the game. And also if nobody's available, then it just plays against recorded previous interaction. So another example is karaoke to teach English. And this is actually from Microsoft Research. And so I have a bit of a video from this idea as well.
English is the lingua franca, or the international language, of technology, business, and the sciences. In China alone, there are more than 300 million English learners and over 50,000 language training schools. Moving further away from the coastal regions to the west, the supply of native English-speaking teachers greatly diminished. Without high-quality English instructors, English as a second language ESL students cannot learn how to communicate effectively. So how can we help improve language learning when a high-quality English-speaking environment is not available?
While many young people are learning English diligently in East Asia, their access to native English-speaking teachers is very limited. What they need is not only a simple traditional paper dictionary, but a new audio-visual learning tool with multiple useful functions. The tool should be able to detect input spelling errors, guess the correct candidates, read a word or example sentence, combine both audio and visual information together in a photorealistic lip-sync talking head.
Karaoke, also known as KTV, is a major pastime amongst Chinese people. We selected this form of expression to make learning more engaging for the target audience. Our talking head technology works by visually capturing different sound articulations of a speaker in roughly 30 minutes of video. The captured audiovisual recording will be used as the training data for building a photorealistic talking head. As the model may move her head during recording, head pose normalization is applied to normalize all frames to fully frontal. The computer extracts, analyzes, and parameterizes all relevant mouth images and forms a library of lip images and the corresponding speech signals. A statistical HMM is automatically trained to characterize how lips move to articulate different speech sounds. In synthesis, the trained statistical model can then predict the trajectory of lip movements for any given text input. The HMM predicted trajectory is used as a guide to select a succinct and smooth mouth sequence from the image library. Here, we show you the rendering results. From left to right, they are the original recording, the HMM predicted trajectory, and the finally synthesized lips movement.
Look out of the window and see if it's raining.
In the final step, the best matched mouth sequence is stitched back to a full head video, and a natural, lip-synced, and photorealistic talking head is animated.
Yes, so that's a great example of using AI signal processing and so on to make a fun game for learning English as a second language. And apparently it was very popular when it was released. We've also done some work on trying to make a game to help children acquire language, and really little kids in this case. So there's a lot of games for acquiring vocabulary, but there's a question about can you help kids learn to string sentences together? And this was inspired by the Duolingo translation tool. I should point out, in case you can't see the words here, it's spelling, the kid is dragging words into the tray, and it's spelling a sentence like, a goat is weeping, and when the words appear, then it causes the action to animate. So in order for the child to make an animation occur, they have to form a correct sentence. If they don't form a correct sentence, they won't get the animation. So they're very motivated to learn how to form a grammatically correct sentence. So the idea is, and the kids can have a lot of fun because they can make illogical things happen, like a fence can cry and so on and so forth, which we left that in because we thought it would be fun for the kids. So we made a predefined world that children can manipulate, and a subject, verb, object, syntactic structure, and word cards that allow language manipulation because it's too hard for kids to type at that age. And then you combine sort of predefined shapes and different pieces in order to make the emotions, and add in emotions and pair them with words and let them be combined in different ways and have positions within the world, so we can do prepositions like in front, behind, above, and so on. And so we analyzed what kids could understand at different ages, and at different ages they could appreciate different parts of the system. Like just at ages 4 to 6, they could start to understand which letters correspond to which words and learn new words. And they were actually able to understand how determiners modify nouns, but not the larger syntactic structure. When they're older, they are able to make the sentences and infer meanings of words that they didn't know before, like amused. They could guess the meaning, like super happy and so on. And they could explain inconsistencies in the images because of, by making some inferences. And then the older kids were able to learn the new meanings of the words through the context and did not want to make the illogical sentences. They were too old for the silly meanings. To summarize, games for learning can engage kids and adults to encourage practicing. And practicing can lead to mastery learning. And if designed correctly, they can increase learning. And good user interface design plus natural language processing research can take game-based learning far beyond vocabulary. All right. So my last subject is advances in peer learning. So what do I mean by peer learning? Peer learning means learning from other peers, from other students, other people that are at your level of learning of the particular subject. So peers remember what it's like not to understand a particular subject. Often when you're someone who's taught or known something for many years, you forget what it's like to be in a state of not knowing, and you're not as good at explaining that concept as somebody who's new to the idea. Furthermore, the way to really learn something is to teach it to somebody else. I think anyone who's been a teaching assistant is aware of this. And hundreds of research papers show the value of peer learning, of students explaining the idea to each other, discussing it. I don't have time to go through those, but there's a lot of evidence for this. But there's a lot of ways we're innovating with peer learning in online learning. So one question is just, can students write good quiz questions? If you let your students write your quiz questions instead of writing them yourself, what happens? Well, it turns out the answer is yes. There's a system called Peerwise available online. And if the instructor has the students write quiz questions in this, they can produce really good quiz questions, it turns out. This system has badges and other social media kind of standards in it. Peerwise is used by dozens, if not hundreds, of courses. And what happens is students write questions, and other students check the correctness of the questions and write answers as well. And the questions have been found to be of high quality in several studies and improve student understanding. And some instructors even make the exams from the peer-wise questions, and that motivates the students to write good questions as well. What about peer grading? So there's a lot of, for online courses, for MOOCs, when there's a lot of students in a class and you don't have problems that can be automatically assessed, what happens is the instructors have the students assess each other's work. But if you teach a design course, like a user interface design course, there's a lot of subjectivity potentially in that grading. So there's a question of, can we do some innovation in this? So the answer is yes. I've actually done some work in trying to innovate in how we have students give peer feedback in a design course. And the key insight was to measure both qualitative and quantitative factors together. So for example, say we have some data, like about the Jeopardy game show, and we want to visualize this data. So say we produce this visualization. So I designed this one to be poor. So what we know about design principles suggests this design is poor. But these two designs, they're probably pretty good, but even as the instructor, I'm not sure which one is best. So we did a study where we got a bunch of students and we had them assess these designs in two ways, both qualitative and objective. The qualitative way is to use what's called heuristic evaluation, which is standard in the human-computer interaction field, where there are guidelines like, is the information visually salient? Are components shown visually appropriately? Is it all displayed in a single visual pattern? And in the other condition, we had students answer questions about the underlying data, like which question was asked in all but 3 years of Jeopardy, which year was most lucrative for the players, which category was strategically best. And what we did was we had people do both the objective evaluation and the heuristic evaluation on these different visualizations. And the great result we found was we took the average of the objective scores, the question scores, and the average of these heuristic guidelines, and we found that they correlated really quite well. We got actually a 0.6 correlation when we removed one outlier in this particular case. So what this shows us is if the participants in the study tended to agree on the qualitative value, then they also agreed on the objective value, and vice versa. And this is exciting because it means if we want to do peer assessment, say in a MOOC, then we have a way to check, we have sort of checks and balances between the qualitative and the quantitative. And this means then if we do have an outlier like the one I showed here, which we had in the data, then that's the one we'd have the instructor look at. So, for example, a couple of the visualizations fell basically on the main trend line, and we don't have to worry about those, and then the instructor would just look at the one that's the outlier. And so this one did very well on the questions, but not so well on the guidelines, and that's actually because I told the students that circles tend to be problematic because the area is hard to judge. And so what we can conclude from this is that I can We can do something like have peer assessment at scale, and as long as the values fall on the trend line, it's fine, and the outliers get looked at by the instructor. We also had a reliability assessment, which showed that the heuristics were actually more reliable than the questions, so we probably needed to ask more questions to make it really reliable. And our future goal is to make a data bank of assessed visualizations. So that's what's really exciting about this, is that we'll be able to have visualizations that have been assessed by students so that we can have a walk-up and use interface for researchers, for academics, where we can discover new design guidelines. In fact, we have discovered some new design guidelines with students doing this method that we have assessed objectively that are useful that I haven't seen published in the literature. We can also assess the heuristic guidelines that are used and continually create new problems without changing the method, just by changing the data that we give students or the questions that are asked. So this could lead to a better understanding of information visualization, just because we have students doing this work. So it's another example of how learning at scale can drive innovation in a field that we wouldn't otherwise be able to do. And finally, my last example is about peer learning. So students talk with peers in peer learning, whether it's in a large classroom lecture hall or in smaller study groups. And in online MOOCs, there's often a large lecture and a discussion forum. But the problem with discussion forums is that, you know, there's the instructor who talks a lot, and there's people in the audience, and usually just a few students are brave enough to raise their hand and talk in a large crowd. So what you want instead are lots of small discussion groups where everybody has to talk to each other. So here I'm showing groups of three. So a question that my group looked at as well is, can small group discussions improve scholastic work online? And it turns out the answer is yes, from our study at least. We found confirmation, which was, we know that in person, people working in groups will get the answers correct more often than those working alone if we have the right incentive structure. And so we did a little study where we had people, these were crowd workers in this case, look at a kind of complicated question, and we told them to discuss, first propose their answer to the multiple choice question. So they read it, proposed an answer like C in this case. And then the students could see what the other students posted, like A, B, C. In this case, two students chose C and one still chose B. And then they all talked about it. And what we told them was, if you all get the answer right, you're going to get a bonus. So their goal was to help each other come up with the right answer. And this has been shown in-person studies of structured peer learning to help improve studying, help improve academic performance, because the students are motivated to help each other understand. And by talking and explaining, they tend to get better understanding. And we had a timer as well. So I'm not going to show the video. But the results are that discussion did improve results. We saw a higher percent of correct final responses for the workers in the groups. And this, especially when we gave this bonus if they all got the answer right, even though they didn't know the answer. And also, this was in crowdsourcing that we found the workers found this enjoyable and left positive feedback about doing this. And we found similar results when deployed in online courses, although it was hard to synchronize people in a MOOC. Here's a sample discussion. Student 2, I think E is the right answer. Student 1, hi, I think E is right too. Hi, this seems to be a nurture versus nature question. Can scent be learned or only at birth? Yeah, but answer A supports the author's conclusion. I felt that about A too. But the conclusion was, which statement would weaken the author's conclusion? So I chose A, showing that scent can be learned at not only at birth. That's why I think E is right. Are you real or fake? This is because crowd workers, sometimes they have robots instead of people. Real. All right. So do we all agree that E was the correct answer? I think so, yes. But I'm sticking with A, since no other water could stimulate olfactory sites. ABD, I suggest that other water could be detected. And, so doing a correction. I thought about C for a while, but it didn't really seem to have anything to do with the topic of scent, and so on. So you see the students are really having an engaged discussion, and they're really trying to figure out what's going on, and so on. All right. So there's lots of natural language processing work we can do with discussions like these. There's something called the Bloom taxonomy, which is a standard in pedagogy about understanding how advanced the thinking is, what level of cognitive level is the discussion. We can automatically detect the levels of understanding, so we could assign teaching assistance to the discussions. We could regroup the students based on how well they're understanding this particular question. We could create new quiz questions on the fly. There's just a lot of opportunities. All right, so we've talked about NLP for writing instruction and studying, AI for automating feedback to help with mastery learning, advances in peer learning, since we know peer learning helps students to understand, and games for learning. So in summary, learning at scale is innovating along many dimensions. It's a very exciting area. We can gain new insights into learning itself, into challenging subjects like information visualization, into group dynamics, like how to help people study together. And there's great opportunities for AI algorithms and applications like games and automating feedback and laying the foundation for personalized tutors. So I hope I've gotten you interested. Thank you very much.